Hello and welcome to episode 3 of the MCU Corner to Corner podcast. I'm Paul and this is my friend Jeff.
Good evening.
And tonight we're talking about Captain America. Yes, Captain America, the first Avenger. Yeah. Ooh. So this is now the fourth film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yep.
And you've seen them all, Jeff. You've seen all these films.
Yeah, I have. Yeah,
from anyone, one corner to another.
Yes, sir. So for anyone,
see what I did there.
Yeah. For anyone who hasn't joined us before, I've seen all the films multiple times. Paul's only seen a handful,
a few,
and even once. Best there. So we are looking at the films in release order, and going from one corner of the universe to the other and beyond, and doing it through the eyes of from one corner of the fandom and another corner of the fandom. So that's where our very clever name has come from, isn't it?
It is. It took us. It took us all 30 seconds to come up with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a splurge of creativity one morning. Yes.
Yeah.
But no, I'll tell you what as well, Jeff. Right. I mean, I'm really enjoying this so far.
Yeah.
Because, like I said in the first podcast, I never felt like I was invested in the storylines. I never really felt like I knew these superheroes, where they really came from or what their stories were, and didn't really feel part of it. But now we're on, what is this now, film number 4?
Yeah.
5? It's film number 5, actually, isn't it? So we've done Iron Man, Incredible Hulk, we've done Iron Man 2, we've done Thor. And now this is number 5.
Yeah.
So wow, we're 5 films in, which is pretty amazing. But now I'm starting to feel like I kind of I feel like things are coming together, Because one thing in this film is that I just to give you a little bit of background on this one, I have seen this one before.
Okay.
I watched it reasonably recently. I think I watched it in summer during probably the first lockdown.
Yeah.
And the reason for that was because that was when I first decided that I was going to watch these films in order. And I was going to watch all of them. So
we did speak about that back then, didn't we?
Yes, we did. And I tweeted it as well, but I never got any further beyond this film. I meant to. Actually, no, that's not true, because after I watched Captain America for the first time, I then watched Agent Carter, because that kind of carries on, right? It sort of continues that sort of 1940s part of the storyline, in a way, to a degree. Now, I hadn't realised that this is the first time we see the Tesseract.
Yeah.
And again, even though I'd seen this, I hadn't made that connection. So I have seen Avengers Assemble years and years ago. We can talk about that next time. But when I first watched this in summer last year, I hadn't realised it was the Tesseract that the bad guys are after. And we were talking about this last time in Thor, right?
Yes, because that's what at the end, don't you?
Right at the end, that's what Loki's after, and we know Loki comes back with the Tesseract in Avengers Assemble, or something happens. But I was really surprised to see it in this one, and it's right at the start. So right at the start, that sequence, right, where what's the bad guy's name? The Red Skull.
Red Skull.
Right?
Yeah,
we don't know he's a Red Skull at that point.
No,
he's just an evil Nazi dude, and the style of kind of Raiders of the Lost Ark. It was giving me real Raiders of the Lost Ark vibes. And he comes into this place, this church or whatever it is, in a shattered town in Norway, and he meets David Bradley. He sort of gives him a bit of a squeeze. And he sees the World Tree, Yggdrasil, on the doorway, and that's where the Tesseract is.
Yeah, it's hidden.
And I went, "Oh my god!" Yeah. I was so excited. Honestly, you could have shaken me down. Honestly, it was brilliant. It was great. It's one of those moments in film where you just want to stand up and shout and yell and scream. So I really, really enjoyed that part of it.
Yeah, it is very kind of in Indiana Jones, isn't it? With that bit, and he sets himself out straight away as he's a bad guy, but you don't know quite how bad at that point because you have
no. That's right. Phase,
And they drive the tank through the wall, don't they? And they've wrecked the town, and he's got his custom Hydra mobile that he drives around. Whatever that.
And
does he kill David Bradley? I think he does, doesn't he? So
he does.
It's all
fairly
kind of, not by the numbers, but it's quite broad strokes. But you immediately know this guy's trouble, and he's
well. That's the thing, isn't it? Yeah, because Yes, that's it. He walks in, he strides into that place.
Yeah.
And you just think, evil Nazi dude. And you've got, the thing that kind of adds to that is the the sort of B-movie, you know, kind of music that that goes on at those sequences. And it just plays on those old black and white serials and the Indiana Jones type thing. You know, it's brilliant. I mean, I love that. They're really mining that for all it's worth.
Yeah.
He strides in with his kind of SS trench coat on and all the rest of it. And you think, yeah, evil Nazi dude, you know, but it's obviously much deeper than that. And we see how far his madness goes as the film progresses. And he takes his face off and all that stuff.
I suppose all of that is a bit of, you know, a homage, I guess, in a way, to, you know, the rumours that Nazis had a sort of a cult division or an interest in that sort of stuff, didn't they?
Yeah, and
that's always been kind of played up a bit in the comic. You know, Hydra have this strong interest in that sort of thing and you know, looking for the test.
Oh, has it? So that narrative goes back to the comics, right?
Yeah, well, maybe not in its sort of very original you know, appearance, but there's certainly been kind of hints of it in things. And, you know, when it all first started, you know, that it was, you know, Hydra was supposed to be the Nazis, wasn't it? And I don't know whether there was a reason they didn't have them or what, but, you know, there's a very famous comic cover of Cap punching Hitler.
Right.
Which was the first issue of the comic.
Oh, is that?
I think it sold, you know, 1 million copies or something in its first week. It was enormous, you know, back when it came out. And
yeah.
And they do kind of pay tribute to that in the film as well, you know, when he's doing his...
With the dancing girls, when he's doing the act.
And he says, you know, I've punched Hitler 40 times or whatever it is. You know?
That's right.
It's
such good fun, this film. I mean, I have to say, I'll ask you what your thoughts are in a minute, but just to summarize mine, I mean, I kind of came away thinking this is probably the best one so far. It's maybe the one I've enjoyed the most. I mean, Iron Man, it's difficult because they're quite different. There are a lot of similarities. There's the same kind of energy. There's a real sort of adventurous excitement that pervades both Iron Man and this film particularly. But it felt to me as though the Captain America film had a little bit more confidence about it. Confidence isn't probably the quite the right word. Remember, I mean, in the first of these podcasts, we said that Iron Man had a sort of indie film vibe to it.
Yeah.
And they didn't know whether it was going to be successful. There was a lot of risk involved, and Robert Downey Jr. brought a lot to it. There was a lot of improvisation going on as they were kind of scripting this thing. But Captain America felt perhaps more accomplished in its confidence. Maybe that's the sort of thing I'm getting at.
Yeah.
Am I making sense?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I don't think you're wrong.
Oh, that's relief.
You know,
it doesn't happen always.
When they were doing Iron Man, of course, they didn't know whether it would work. They didn't know whether this whole universe was going to take off. And I think even at that point, it was a bit of a, you know, pie in the sky kind of dream to do it, you know. And that's why I think the little tag with Fury at the end of Iron Man was just chucked in there, you know, oh, this will be fun.
Yeah, we'll
do this, and maybe one day, you know, it will happen.
But we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, quite. But I suppose by the time they came to doing Captain America, they were starting to formulate this future, and certainly up to Avengers, and things had been rolling for a while by that point. And yeah, I think the confidence would be certainly starting to grow, and you can see that across the whole film, I think, and just in terms of you know, the kind of scope of it, you know, the direction and the performances in it as well.
And
it started to get a little bit more you know, not complex as such, but, you know, it opens with the flashbacks, and, you know, it ends with a, you know, different setting as well, and it's kind of leaping around a little bit and starting to set things up a bit more and build that world.
See, and that's quite an important thing as well. And actually, this made me kind of realize why perhaps you suggested we watch the films in this order, in release order,
as opposed
to chronologically, chronologically in the timeline.
I mean,
because now things are actually starting to come together, aren't they?
You'd have to have skipped the beginning, watched the most bulk of the film, stop it just before the end, then, you know, go back to the others and then watch, you know, the beginning of Captain America, and then maybe wait a bit, watch the end of it after another film.
And watch the rest of it.
Yeah.
Which gets a bit mad.
Yeah, I wonder if someone somewhere was, now this is an edit task if anyone's up for it, but taking the films and chopping them up into a complete kind of sequential thing, you know, that would be a...
You would have to have a lot of time on your hands.
Well, time to do it and then time to watch it. You need like 3 days solid to watch through it all. I think, again, it's all fairly, it's pretty clear and doesn't get overly complex in terms of, you know, it's the narrative timeline of it all makes sense. And I don't think it's getting overly complicated. So, yeah, watching it in release order is not, it's not detrimental. You know, it was designed to be like that. So yeah, but yes, you see what I mean about.
I do. Yeah. I was starting to get that last night. I was kind of thinking, now I see it. Now I get it.
Yeah,
Jeff was right. I may have doubted you at some point early in our conversations, but now I'm thinking, nah.
Well, we did have someone.
Jeff knows what he's talking.
Yeah, someone
about.
On Twitter said they agreed with me, didn't they? So I was like, yeah, I knew I wasn't mad. So I mean, it's only one person.
I was on the phone to somebody just a couple of days ago, actually, and I was telling them that we were doing this. And she said to me, what order are you watching them in? And I said, well, release order. And she goes, oh, really? Like it was a big slap in the face or something. Like, why would you do that? How are you betraying the Marvel Universe by doing it this way?
I had someone...
But we're not.
Well, I had someone say similar on LinkedIn, actually, earlier this week. But actually, the thing is, when the films were coming out in real time, You couldn't watch them in anything other than the order they came out in.
This is true.
So
this is true.
You know, now, if you've never watched them, you've got the luxury of going back and watching them chronologically if you want to. But, you know, I'm just going to do a bit of gatekeeping here, you know. But when I started back in the day, that wasn't an option. So it's up to the viewer. But, yeah, I'd go with it, you know, release order.
I was going to say, we don't know what films they're going to release in the future. I mean, okay, so we know the immediate future, but the sort of medium to long-term future, they might easily release a film now, which happens in the 1930s or the 1960s or in the far future. And we don't. So you kind of think, well, if you're going to watch them in chronological order and you get past, I don't know, you get past maybe the 1950s or something, and then they release a film set in the 1950s, and in that part of this narrative, then it's like, well, hold on. Now what do? You have to go back and watch them all again.
It'll start getting complicated because, you know, there's things that can happen in space that happen which look like the future, but it's happening at the same time as something else.
Yeah, that's true as well.
You know, and that doesn't work to then say, oh, well, I'll watch that one right at the end because it doesn't work like that within all the other bits that connect it. So, yeah, you really enjoyed the film then.
I did, yeah. I thought this was great fun. To be honest, I thought this was great fun the first time I watched it, you know, in the summer. I really enjoyed it. But I think, I enjoyed it more the second time around. And sometimes that does happen, doesn't it?
Yes.
You know, because first time you don't know what's coming up. You might have a bit of an idea, but it's the first time you sat through the film from beginning to end. And sometimes there can be so much going on that it all kind of hits you in like a really fast cannonade of just visual and audio information. Yeah. And you can't take it all in unless you're superhuman or something, or you've had some kind of serum injected into you. But so second time round, you can kind of relax. You've got an idea of things you've got an idea of what's coming up, even if you can't perhaps remember all the detail. But then as it starts to unfold, and you can enjoy it a little bit more, I think you can take the time to appreciate some of the finer, subtler points of the narrative. And this for me is what shows off the qualities of a good film over an inferior film. It's rewatch value, because if you don't get something different the second time round, or something deeper, or pick up on elements that you missed the first time round, then it means in some ways actually the storyline or the narrative or the production or whatever it is actually quite shallow. And that's not a bad thing if the film is good enough and it just entertains and thrills and everything else. And I think maybe that's what a lot of maybe that's what the expectations of a superhero film probably are. Certainly, as we talked previously about the kind of elitist literati of the movie world, these guys who are out there, you know, sort of trashing superhero films. They think, well, they're not deep. They're pretty shallow, really, in the scheme of things. You know, we said ourselves, didn't we? They're not Taxi Driver.
No.
But they still have layers. You know, they're not shallow films.
No,
and this is what is so great about these films. And I'm kind of experiencing that now. You know, I never for one moment thought that these films are really shallow, but I did wonder maybe there are some depths I'm not picking up. But now I've seen five films on the trot, one after the other, I'm starting to see multiple narratives kind of coming together. Mm. And I'm really, really enjoying that journey, Jeff.
So that's great. You know, that's one of the things about it that appeals to me and, you know, many others. But it is layered. And like we said before, it's not The Revenant or Raging Bull, or things like that in terms of its kind of, you know, dramatic sensibilities and things. It doesn't matter. It's not to say that, you know, we've talked about this before, but it's not to say that the work in this stuff and the character, actions isn't dramatic and it doesn't, resonate with people and doesn't move with people, but it's not as, I was gonna say, it's not as deep as some other stuff, but that's not right. But do you know what I mean? It's kind of lighter in a way. But you know, people still care about these characters and they have a connection with them. And then, you know, like you said, all the interconnectivity with the storylines and things and the Easter eggs, that's what kind of brings people back. And for me, I watch these films again because I've enjoyed them first and foremost.
Mm.
And I want to kind of get more out of it, you know, see what else I can discover, kind of, you know, remember it better, get it kind of clearer in the head. But then there's other films like, Gravity, for example. Great film, but I don't need to watch it again. Some things, they may well be excellent films in their performances and the writing and, you know, all of that. And that's not saying that the Marvel stuff isn't. It's how it connects you with you, really. And I think with the Marvel films, there's also, an element of what your personal preferences are. You know, I think we might have said before, someone might have only gone to watch the Thor films because they like that character, or, you know, they like that kind of, you know, fantasy type thing, or they maybe only watch Captain America because they like the war films. And as it goes on, it kind of gets harder to only selectively watch things, but it still gives you that option, I think. And, you know, you said that Captain America kind of gelled with you, you know, more, and you enjoyed it more than the others. And that's probably, you know, the character, the setting of it all, the sort of the feel of it, you know, like you said, the Indiana Jones type of thing. And it does have a different feel to the others. And the films do have different feels. You know, when you get to Captain America Winter Soldier, it is completely different.
Oh, really?
Not in a bad way. In a very, very good way.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah. And, I think, these films are not all the same. The feel of them and the kind of overall vibe is similar, but they do different things, and they are
different. They're quite independent. They have their own identity. Right?
They do. Yes, I think so. Yeah. I mean, like watching Falcon and Winter Soldier on Disney Plus at the moment, it fits with the other Captain America films in terms of its style and what it's the things that it's kind of tackling and its subject matter and stuff like that, whereas WandaVision is, well, like none of the other stuff before, but its finale its finale was kind of traditional kind of MCU action type stuff, but they all exist on their own and have their own style to them, you know. So tell me more about what you thought of the film.
Well, it's quite interesting what you say, because this brings into mind something that I was thinking about while I was watching it, because when I was a kid, I actively avoided Captain America completely. I didn't engage with Captain. If I saw a Captain America comic in the news, I'd just go straight past it and buy Superman instead something else, you know, Fantastic Four, X-Men. But I never really liked any of that kind of star-spangled, gaudy Americana that it always seemed to promote you know, even when I was a kid, I just steered clear of that stuff. I didn't want it in my life. And I think that's a real shame. I obviously missed out, because certainly what came through with the film is that although that's an element of it, it's used in quite an ironic sense. Mm. You know, the fact that, you know, Steve Rogers undergoes this incredible transformation as part of a military slash scientific experiment. And as soon as it's successful, they don't want him. Yeah. The people who do want him is the senator and his PR MacGuffins to kind of sell the war, yeah, enlist more soldiers, yeah, you know, get the guys
it's not
out
what there. What he signed up for, is it? You know,
that's it. And that for me was a really brilliant element. I love that. That sort of self-referential, yeah, kind of ironic sort of take on the whole Captain America, yeah, kind of thing, you know. And I don't know if that was ever there in the comics, because, as I said, I actively avoided them. But, you know, I'm kind of hoping that it was there to a degree. And in some ways, it doesn't matter, even if that was Captain America, if he actually was a real kind of ambassador for the whole American kind of pop culture or pre-pop culture type thing. You know, it's part of history, you know, as being that. And part of history is as having a sort of postmodern ironic take on it as well. You know, I love it. And for me, what that means is that here's a character that has got a rich history to, yeah, mind that perhaps the producers can have a little bit of fun with. You know, as long as they're respectful to, yeah, the story material and its history, its legacy and all the rest of it. It seemed to me that it was. And again, so many other things that were coming through in it. I enjoyed very early on, and again, the first time around I watched it, I really, really loved that World Expo, the kind, yeah, of proto Stark Expo. We saw Stark's Expo in Iron Man 2 as a, yeah, kind of, you know, as an old school cine film. And this was a similar kind of thing. It was almost like, well, Stark was there stealing the show at the World Expo, which was full of, I gather, probably loads and loads of Marvel Easter eggs. There was the World of Future Marvel, or so what was it called?
Yes,
the, Modern Marvels.
Yeah, that, yeah, was it. And the original Human Torch was there in a display tank.
Was he? Oh.
Yeah. talking about kind of, you know, the legacy of Cap. You know, I think in the comics, you know, my kind of understanding of it is that he was sent out to fight the Nazis and everything, but also simultaneously used as the kind of poster boy for the war effort.
He was, yeah,
and all of that. Yeah. And the film takes that slightly differently in a kind of ironic way, which also I think works really well for Steve Rogers' character to show just how much he wants to do the right thing for his country, and parading around like a monkey on a bike as he draws is not what he wants.
That's right.
Do.
Yeah.
And
not what he wants.
No. And I think there were worries when they were doing the film about how would it play in other countries, this guy with the American flag on his chest.
Oh, really?
Some countries, yeah, don't like America.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's why it was subtitled The First Avenger, because in places like Russia, it was like, The First Avenger, Captain America. Yeah. And yeah, quite. And maybe even not mentioned, you know,
yeah,
just,
yeah,
The First Avenger. And of course, as things have gone on, you know, that's kind of, you know, it's just
been, it's become less of an issue, I suppose.
Yes, right? I think so, yes.
Less of a,
because I think what they did with the character is made him less specifically about kind of the American dream and just about the kind of standing up for what's right, that
yeah,
kind of works, yeah, for everyone, and whilst still being kind of that American, you know, the dream and the ideology of all of that, but it could be applied to everyone, I think, and not,
yeah, it's a universal, like, human condition.
Yes, and not feel like, well, he's really just pro-America, and, you know,
yeah,
it's, you know, he's going to come and get in these other countries and stuff. I don't think they did that at all with him in it. Yeah, I think we could talk a bit more about his character in a bit, but yeah, I think it worked really well for him.
So what's your history with Captain America then? Have you got much of a knowledge of the world outside the Marvel films for this one, or were you coming to it kind of from fresh?
I don't remember reading it when I was younger, like you said, you actively kind of avoided it. Which I don't think is unreasonable, because, you know, it did kind of play to that American audience, and, you know, the comics and things, and that's you know, what it was aimed for. That's why we had Captain Britain, I suppose, eventually, because Yeah, that's what would appeal to us, you know.
You guys can have Captain Britain or something, yeah, whatever. Pass back to the Limeys.
Captain Britain.
Captain Britain.
I didn't read him, you know, specifically when I was younger or anything. And a bit like with Thor, after the film came out, you know, started to kind of go back and read more stuff. You know, there's quite famous.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, there's like the Ed Brubaker stories, which is kind of the Winter Soldier stuff. That's really well known, a really good kind of run that the films take inspiration from. And then I've read other books as well. So it probably won't surprise you to know that I enjoyed the film a lot.
That was going to be my next question.
But that'll be a common thread here, I think, with all of you.
Yeah, I kind of get that.
Yeah. So, yeah, maybe there'll be one that you hate at some point, you know, to mix it up a bit. But, yeah, I really enjoy it. Like you said, you know, it's kind of it's a bit boy's own adventure kind of thing.
Isn't it? Unashamedly so.
Yeah. The action in it is really good as well, but a little bit like Iron Man. And I think, having thought more about the first Avengers this week, kind of clarified what I meant when I spoke about the Iron Man action. The stuff is really good, but it's quite short, and it often feels a bit like you know, it's cut off before it really gets going. So there's that great bit where, you know, he rides his bike into the Hydra base at the end, and then there's a bit of kind of, they got the flamethrowers and stuff, and it's really cool. But I was like, I wanted a bit more. In fact, all of the action sequences in Marvel films, they are driving the plot in some way. That there is things happening in it still, and character stuff, and it's not just stuff blowing up. There is a reason that this is, you know, this is happening.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Yeah,
It's not just action for action's sake, you know. It's not like John Wick going off on someone, you know.
But there is a lot of fun to be had in that, though.
There is, yeah. The right concept. But you go into it knowing that, you know, you want to see a guy kill a guy with a pencil, you know. I really like Steve Rogers. And Chris Evans.
Oh, he's brilliant.
I love him.
He's really, really good.
He's really good. And Evans embodied the role brilliantly. And you know, in some ways, you know, like Downey was almost a real life Tony Stark. Evans has become a real life Rogers with some of his kind of political tweeting and stuff. Standing up for certain things, which is quite cool. But the character is. He's just a good guy, the nice guy. He, you know, he gets bullied at the start and things, and he, you know, he's short and he's skinny and he's poorly and everything, and you know, he's getting picked on in the alley, but he will stand up to the bullies all the time.
He stands his ground.
Yeah,
all day long.
And you know, Bucky comes and helps out, but he'd have stood there all the time, and so. As a character, to kind of distill him down, he will put himself first, but in a selfless way. So to protect other people, and you see that in the bit when he dives on the grenade, and he doesn't
know it's fake. That's right. I'm just thinking of that.
Yeah. But no one else does it, and that's where
they all run away.
They run away, don't they?
Which, to be honest. Yeah. Probably what I would do.
Yes, I think a lot of people would
do it. But then that's the difference. That's why I'm not a superhero like Captain America, you know.
Yeah, I was watching.
I think you're right.
I could be more like Steve Rogers. No, I don't think I could throw myself on a grenade. You know, I know it's fictional. But
you don't know. Extreme circumstances.
Well, yes, you don't know, yeah.
Might warrant that.
But that's when, you know, Dr. Erskine says, you know, he's the one. You know. And so I think there's two things there. You know, Rogers will stand up to the bullies, whether they are a guy beating him in an alleyway, someone picking on a kid, or, you know, a megalomaniac alien, but he will put himself in harm's way for the safety of others. And there's a couple of others,
because he makes that point, doesn't he, when Dr. Erskine says to him, do you want to kill Nazis? And he thinks about it and he says, I don't want to kill anyone, you know. And then he says something about, I don't care how big the bullies are, I want to stop them, or something like that. I'm making a bit of a fudge of it.
Yeah, but, I don't know, it's not like about bullies.
It's the bullies. It's the people. It's the big guy picking on the little guy. That's what he takes offense at. And he doesn't stay down, no matter how. Go on.
And that takes that, you know, that element of Captain America, and that's what worked with the film version and made it applicable to everyone, because it's really simple. I don't like bullies, and I will stand up to them. And then, you know, when, of course, he gets the shield, that's the visual representation of you know, protection and defense at the same time. Absolutely. You know, it's his personality, you know, put into an object, really. I think he's, you know, he's a great character, and I like that, you know, he's quite an innocent, and, you know, he says to Peggy, you know, they're in the cab, and he says, I got beat up in that alley and that one.
And then they go back to New York.
Yeah. That's it. And he says a bit about, you know, I've never danced with a girl, I think, is it?
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, the end line is so strong, I think, you know, when they're on the intercom together. And I like that aspect of him, that he'd be on your side. I was going to say he'd have your back, but he'd be in front of you, keeping you safe. Yeah. You know,
he would, wouldn't he? He'd put himself in his big shield in front of you right there.
And like I said, I like that he's an innocent guy. He's a kind of naive and sweet, you know, soul, really. And that relationship he has with Peggy, I think it's the first kind of real love in the MCU. Obviously, Jane and Thor, but that was a bit more kind of fancy.
They hadn't got to that stage.
And it was probably more kind of, you know, passion based than anything initially, and you know, Tony and Pepper.
What in Thor? Do you think?
Yeah, well, she obviously thinks he's quite hot, doesn't she? You know, but it's not. It's a different sort
physical
of
physical thing.
Yes, yeah. But with Steve and Peggy, you know, it endures, and I think she likes him for who he is, rather than necessarily what he looks like. I suppose it's a bit of a bonus when he gets the serum and stuff.
It probably helps when he gets his pecs.
Yeah, there's that little bit where
that thing where
she touches his pec, doesn't she? Which is a bit of an ad-lib.
Just like that, doesn't she?
Yeah.
Just does that, pokes him. It's quite funny. Yeah.
He's still the same person inside. And
I think that's critical, actually, isn't it?
He doesn't... There's a thing about, you know, does the super soldier serum, does it corrupt people, and or does it basically enhances their inherent qualities, which is why Red Skull is a maniac. And with Steve, there's nothing bad there. You know, it just takes the good and amplifies it. So yeah, I really like things with Peggy, and also Peggy is I like the way she gives the other guys at the army base, she gives them shit, you know.
She does. Yeah. She wallops a guy in the ranks, doesn't she?
Yeah.
She totally floors him.
And she won't take any grief from them. And you can see another bit with Steve where they have to do the flag thing. They got to get the top of the flag pulled down. And he pulls out the key thing or whatever, and it falls over, whereas all the other guys have been trying to scramble up it and stuff.
And
she thinks, you know, that's brilliant, because he's smart as well as...
He's thinking as well, yeah.
He's not physically able, but, you know, he's got the brains there. So they've got a really nice relationship, I think, and, you know, the end where, again, he puts himself first to his detriment for... you know, the good of everybody else.
He sacrifices everything, doesn't he? Yeah. You know, his entire life is gone. And when he comes back, all the people he knows, especially Peggy, they've gone. Admittedly, he doesn't know that's what's going to happen.
No.
But he thought he was going to die. So
and he was prepared to do it, to people. And that bit on the phone, you know, with the pair of them is heartbreaking, really. And it's played so well. And, you know, Hayley Atwell was just brilliant in the film. And the end of Captain America, you know, it's a bit of a tearjerker, I think. You know, I felt there was a real kind of bond between them, again, this may be a comic book film, but there's still real feeling there, and I think that's tantamount to the performance that the pair of them give to it and their chemistry that they had together. The end of the film when he wakes up is so brilliant and eerie.
Yeah.
And that bit where they're playing the baseball game.
And he recognizes it.
Yeah, he said, "I was there."
Because he was there, yeah. And then he smashes out the place, and we see it for what it is, just a kind of set almost, isn't it?
Yeah, in a warehouse, yeah. He runs into Times Square. And what a kind of
culture shock.
Yeah, rude awakening, into modern life and everything. And just brilliantly done. Eerie and kind of, it's quite unsettling to start with. You feel, I think, as disorientated as he is.
Yeah, we do, actually. Yeah, you're right. Even though that's our world, right? That's what we're used to. We come from this place. We shouldn't feel that kind of disjoint. Yeah. But I think, actually, what that is a testament to is how brilliantly they create this kind of 1940s, almost noirish kind of world that we spent the last 2 hours or so in.
Yeah, so it's
1940s setting. I know it's probably quite stylized in a lot of ways, but that's fine because it's a comic book superhero type film. But it's so involving. It's so in the moment. You feel it. And when I went to watch Agent Carter, part of what drove me to watch that was because I wanted to stay in that setting. That world. I loved it. The idea of a secret scientific / military / federal organization, working from behind a bookshop or an antique shop or whatever it was. It's brilliant. I love the idea of that.
And like you said,
Peggy Carter is so good. She's so engaging as a character, and Hayley plays her brilliantly. Yeah. She just pulls you in. It's fantastic.
And I think that's you're exactly right. That's why the end is even more jarring, because you've just spent all that time in this really stylized but very believably realized world of the war. And that's what makes it more kind of shocking. So what did you think of things of even Bucky?
Bucky! Oh, no! When he fell off the train, man. Oh, that was hard.
Did you also have a little tear there,
No, I never cry at these things. What's that? I'm an emotional cold face. Doesn't happen with it. Don't remind me of Bucky. I really loved their friendship. It was brilliant because he was there when Steve was a little guy.
Yeah.
And he, like you said, he was there to help Steve out of trouble. And then Steve rescues him from the Red Skull's lair or weapons factory or whatever it is, and then they go through this montage of adventures together halfway, and the team assembles around him. They got their crack squad, and it's brilliant, and I love that. And then they go on this fatal mission on the train, and Bucky, despite his bravery and everything else, cops it in the end. And I was gutted. I really felt it there.
You're right. The friendship is brilliant, and
yeah.
Bucky's there for Steve when he can't, defend himself, and then when Steve can, he's equal with Bucky. He doesn't abandon.
Yeah, him, yeah.
He doesn't think, "Oh, I don't need you anymore." But I don't think that he kind of overshadows him. They had a friendship that you could believe had been around for a while.
Definitely. It absolutely convinced. And I think that's the thing about Steve Rogers, isn't it? Is that his qualities don't change. From when he's a little guy to when he's a big guy, he's still essentially the same person, but he's able to do so much more because he has a lot of strength, a lot of speed, and everything else.
He fulfills the potential that he always wanted. That's very interesting what you said there. He's essentially the same guy, and that was one of Chris Evans' worries about taking on this, because Steve is so pure and...
Yeah.
He's never going to become a baddie or anything. And is there any kind of dramatic change and challenge for the character?
Any development.
And in fact, I had a conversation with a guy on Twitter today
Oh, you didn't, did you?
I did, yeah, you know, one of those.
Oh, Jeff. And, we've all been there, mate.
We've been there. No, how did that go? But he said he didn't think the characters evolved hugely, and I said I didn't agree with that. I said I don't think that we're going to end a film or end a trilogy completely changed, because that's not, it's not really what you want here, but they do get challenged and they do evolve and face difficulties and you know, they do change.
No, I'd agree with you, Jeff, because I think a lot of these things are more natural. You know, as people, we do change and we do evolve, but we do it over decades.
Yeah.
You know, I you know, neither of us are the same person, people we were sort of 20 years ago and more. But, you know, but in a film or even a series of films, you're trying to force these changes in, what, 2 hours?
Yeah.
And, okay, so let's say the film happens over a period of months or even a few years. You know, it's very difficult to get that across, and especially in something like an action adventure film where, okay, it's, you don't always expect that. Well, actually, no, that's not true. I think nowadays we do expect a bit of character development, and this is probably why, you know, what spurred this person on Twitter to kind of say such things. But I think, you know, I think it's more naturalistic to have things happen more gradually. And I think a lot of us, like these guys, are defined by the things that happen to us and how we respond to them, and whether we're sort of proactive or whether we're more reactive.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
It's very much a proactive character. He's the guy who doesn't stay down. He gets up. He takes on the bullies.
Yeah.
And that is what drives him to become the force that he is after after his transformation. And that in turn drives a lot of other stuff within the narrative. He takes it to the Red Skull, right? He moves it, he gets the guys out of prison because nobody else was going to.
Yeah.
So all that, you know, so, and again, as a force for narrative drive, that's exactly what the central character to me should do, certainly in this sort of film.
And I think you're right. You know, you and I and everyone are not the same we were 5-10 years ago, you know, broadly speaking, you are, but you've evolved and changed.
Yeah, there are certain characteristics that remain the same. Yes. So Tony Stark will always be a bit of an arsehole.
Yeah.
But he's learned the error of some of his past decisions. Yeah. He's making remedies for them. He's turning things around. And his character arc is in realizing that and realizing what he does next. For Steve, I was going to call him Steve Jobs there for a minute, which shows what's happening in my head, right? Steve Rogers. For Steve Rogers, it's how he becomes kind of liberated on receiving the transformation.
Yeah.
And there's two ways it can go. He can either say, well, I'm all powerful now and I can become an absolute dominant force in the world like the Red Skull, or actually I can use my powers for good like a superhero. It's a little bit cliched, but the way this film treats it is so believable.
Yeah.
I think in the hands of somebody else, some, you know, an inferior film studio, or maybe even, you know, back in the 80s when a lot of this stuff was going around, it could have turned out completely differently. Mm-hmm. It really could have just become a kind of selling tool for Americana PR. You know what I mean? But it's so intelligently done in this film. I completely went with it.
The Red Skull, you know, was
Red Skull.
Brilliant. You know, the prosthetics on him was really good. He was quite quite an element of kind of vanity to him. You know, he's having that painting done and you know, he's effectively disfigured and stuff, but I could never tell whether he kind of liked that or not. Do you know what I mean? I think he probably did, you know, by getting the painting done, and he's just he's kind of he's a bit of a caricature in a way of kind of, you know, the hit, the type thing. But
but I think something that just occurred to me as you said that about his painting, right? I mean, this guy wants to take the Reich away from Hitler, right? He's as much of an enemy to Hitler as the rest of the world is, and is probably far more dangerous because of the power he's got from this Tesseract thing. But there's also that which I really like. There's a kind of arty streak going through it as well. Arty streak going through his arrogance. The fact that he's having and even though we see him in silhouette, we know, I think it's pretty clear that he's got his skull face on, right?
Yes,
the silhouette is very skull-like. We don't see it at that point. So presumably the artist is
that's why he's shaking, doing it, isn't he?
Skull.
Yeah.
Which is which is what did Hitler call it? It's like deviant art or something like that. You know, abominable art. The sort of paintings that he had destroyed, if they weren't pretty landscapes and you know, all that sort of stuff, Hitler didn't like it. So anything which was edgy and contentious, in his words, he wanted it all destroyed. Right. And so here's the Red Skull making something which, I can imagine if Hitler would look at that painting of the guy in a full-on Nazi uniform or Nazi-ish uniform with a red skull on the top of it, what would he say about that?
Yeah, yeah.
So the red skull guy, he knows perhaps that's what he probably, maybe it's in a deleted scene or something, or something somewhere where he wraps it up and sends it to Hitler by Berlin or something, you know, and Hitler goes, "What's his father?" Sorry. But it's, you know, and there's this great moment where again it's very arty, and he's it's when the cap and the guys are kind of taking it to him, and there's obviously a lot of, we don't see all the fighting, it's all in that kind of montage.
Yeah, there's a montage.
And then at the end of it, the Red Skull is kind of striding the ruins of this town.
Yeah.
It's smoking, it's flame, you know, the flames are sort of going out, the embers are dying, and he sort of strides this figure like from the apocalypse, like from the end of the world, this nightmare vision. I love the cinematography and that sort of thing. You know, that really, the care and attention the directors and the, you know, directors of photography put in these things, the people who construct these scenes and frame it.
Yeah.
You know, you're a camera guy, you know what it's, you know what I'm talking about. When you've got time to get the thing you want.
Time and money.
I'm getting emotional. Oh, I love all that.
It's beautiful. You know, there's a lot of comic kind of splash panels. That's what you call them.
Where
you get a page or two pages.
Is that the technical term?
It is, yeah. And, you know, that's just a big splash of, you know, the heroes fighting or someone breaking out of a window or, you know, whatever it might be. And there's a lot of that stuff kind of brought to life in the films. And I was going to say another bit. There's a bit towards the end of Captain America where Red Skull is talking to his, you know, his cronies and by plane, and you know, getting ready for kind of the final battle, and he's got, you know, 10 people or whatever it is in front of him, and it's played like that's all you see, and then he turns around and he says, you know, "Hail Hydra," and then the camera goes up, and the aircraft hangars full of them, you know, and
it's
like, oh shit.
Yeah, now we're in trouble, boys.
But, you know,
it's going to kick off now.
You know, deception with the shot there. You know, and then that fight they have in the plane at the end is great, because it's again quite small and it's just about the two of them. But they are being thrown all over the place, and a bit of anti gravity going on as the plane is crashing and stuff. And
brilliant,
the shield is bouncing around. It's a really good, kind of quite strong fight there. So I like that as well.
Yeah, it is. It's always good to see the hero and the antagonist actually slugging it out with each other in some way. And in a film full of special effects and lots of other different things going on, it can be really difficult, I think, to get the idea that there's some actual power and physicality and emotion going on.
Yes.
It becomes all about the special effects. You know, if you have King Kong versus Godzilla, that's essentially what it is. And that's a different sort of thing.
And I think that's one of the things, again, that these films do, is that they don't lose sight of the character stuff. So you get a lot of fights that are hero versus villain, of course. But it's always focused on them and not so much kind of the big effects around it. You do get all of that stuff as well, but it's never.
Yeah, and there was a splash of it in this one, wasn't there, with the sort of light bolts and things coming off. But they didn't dominate the scene. They weren't what the scene was about.
You don't lose track or sight of what they're doing, and you know, the fact that they're still talking between each other and things as well. So we put out on Twitter that we were recording this session tonight, and we asked for people to tell us what they thought about Captain America, the First Avenger. So, first up, we had at Mr_G Ward, who goes by the name of Robot of Death, and we've chatted to him a bit, and he's a nice guy.
Wow.
And he just said it's one of my favourites. He has started rewatching the films alongside what we're doing, isn't he? Which is amazing, really. So, thank you,
Mr. G Ward.
Yeah, thank you, Robot of Death. That's great. And we also had at DWFan89, which is Lautaro Medina, and he said he thinks it's an underrated entry in the MCU. It does a great job to establish Cap and his supporting. So Kev, who's at ice_V75, he says part one of the best MCU trilogy.
Oh, really?
That's interesting.
What do you think? I haven't seen the others, so I couldn't.
No, you can't. Yeah, I was going to say, you can't comment on that yet, and that sounds like I'm telling you.
you're not allowed to comment.
Yeah, I won't let you. Is it the best trilogy?
It's a good, well, it's good so far from the first one. I mean, it pulled me in. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, do you know what? He's probably right in terms of consistency in terms of quality across them and also not dipping and just, in fact, escalating in quality. I think he's right. Yeah, Kev, I think I will agree with you on that. And then this next one is from Nabil, who's at Neo X on 619. I've probably pronounced that completely wrong. But he says, which is the danger with usernames, isn't it? He says,
You're so natural reading out those Twitter handles.
Yeah. I'll have to practice this a bit more.
Dear listeners, make them as complex as you possibly can when Jeff.
Please do,
lots of underscores, lots of numbers.
In the string of numbers.
Characters.
Yeah.
Sorry, go on.
So he says, Cap 1 is weirdly underrated. It's no Winter Soldier or Civil War, but it holds up pretty well. So that's kind of tying in with what Lautaro says and Kev as well. So, I think he's also right. It was, as you've just discovered, it's a great film, but, with as the MCU kind of expands and, they take the training wheels off a little bit. That's when the fun really begins. And then Kendrick, who's at DDP Kendrick, he says, maybe it's my nostalgia, but I thought it was great, just as good as his other two movies.
Oh, brilliant.
So that gives you, a bit of an idea.
There's a lot of positivity for the Cap out there, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think there seems to be a general kind of feeling that this is a very good film. And okay, maybe not the best given what comes after, I suppose. And I have to say, now on the back of this, I'm really looking forward to the next two Cap films, because if they're really that much better than this one, and this is already at a high benchmark, then I'm really excited.
I'll tell you what you've got Avengers to do next, then Iron Man 3, and Thor: Dark World, and then Winter Soldier. So a few films to go.
Yeah,
the beginning.
I was looking forward to the Thor film so much,
because
I thought that was going to be the one that really sold it to me. And as we said in the last episode of these podcasts, I didn't feel it was quite up there. I still thought it was good, but not quite satisfying in certain ways that I couldn't quite put my finger on. Although we come up with a few ideas, but this one really hit every mark for me. I thought it was absolutely just a really solid film. As we said earlier, with lots of indie vibes, lots of those kind of serial, Saturday morning serial sort of things.
Yeah, all of that,
And a real sort of, it tread that line, I think, between highly stylized superhero action that is completely OTT and all the rest of it, which we kind of expect, and yet still manage to have a foot grounded in the real world. And I think the moment where those two things really blended was when we move from Cap being on the stage with the dancing girls, turning around and giving Hitler a punch in a sock in the cheek again and again and again. And suddenly he's in front of, let's be honest, a really difficult crowd. The GIs who've been there, who've lost friends, who actually fight in this stuff.
Bring out the girls again, they say.
Yeah. And the fact that, and great as well that Steve gets that, he's not on some kind of bizarre ego trip. He gets it, he understands it, he empathizes with these guys, and still turns it around, goes out, rescues them. And there is so much we could probably talk about this film for another 2 hours, Jeff, because
there is a lot. We've only kind of scratched the surface, and as we're doing these podcasts, and we've sort of talked a bit about this before, but there starts to become more things with each of the characters and their films that would be worth looking back at when you've seen the others and seen their whole journeys.
You know, a bonus episode.
Yeah. And of course, we remembered Agent Carter tonight because I was thinking, we'll make a WandaVision and things in time. But
we're going to have to cover the series, aren't we?
Yeah, yeah. Agent Carter would be before those, really. So it might have to be a very special episode of MCU.
Special episode. I love the idea of that.
And cover that.
So the final thing perhaps to maybe take a quick look at is how we set up the Avengers Assemble, because we've got the now traditional post-credit sequence, and it's a little bit different from the other ones. I mean, it starts relatively similar. It's Steve Rogers is slugging out a punch bag and venting some frustrations, the fact that he seems to be lost in the 21st century, and Nick Fury walks in, covered in shadow, reveals himself, says something, blah, 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 blah. That was it, wasn't it? Steve Rogers says, "You want me back in the world? I want you to save it," he says.
Yeah.
And then we go into an Avengers Assemble trailer. Yeah. So, and I just wonder how exciting must have that have been back in the day.
Well, yeah, because you were waiting for the post-credits thing, and I don't think anyone knew that it was a sort of proper trailer, which also has a brilliant tagline of "Some Assembly Required," which is
May 2012, "Some Assembly Required."
It was really exciting because it was that confirmation that all of this was coming together, and in another 10 months or whatever it was, all these people that we'd just been seeing were going to be getting together for the first time. And, as a fan of the comics and stuff, growing up and having been reading them for a long time, prior to this, that's very exciting. But I think probably for anyone who just kind of joined it, with Iron Man, that was a really exciting prospect as well, because I genuinely don't think it's been done like this before. On TV, crossovers and serialized stories and things, soaps go on for years and years and things, and you're a big fan of the DC shows, and I know they cross over.
Yeah, love them. Like
that. But you know there's not really been anything on this scale in cinema. It's still as exciting now as it was 12 years ago, I think, really.
Brilliant, isn't it?
If not more.
Excellent
so
stuff. Brilliant stuff. So that's us on Captain America. Hope you enjoy listening to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks next for tuning time, in.
Yeah, thank you very much, and thanks also to the guys to everybody who sent some tweets in as well.
Yeah,
we'd love
a
big engagement on the Twitter feed. So do please check us out. What's the hashtag, Jeff?
Our handle is.
Is that the right lingo?
That is the right lingo, I believe. Yeah, our Twitter handle is at MCUC2C with the number 2.
Yeah, C2C. See what we did there?
Yeah.
So there's no underscores C2. Or anything or weird special characters.
We did debate about that for a while, didn't
we? Reach out.
On a handle. So if you're listening to this and you haven't followed us, please do. We'd really like it.
Please do. We'd love it. And of course, next time we are talking about
the first big one.
Avengers. Avengers. I was kind of leaning in for you there, Jeff.
Oh, you wanted me to go Avengers Assemble, which is what you call it in the UK, and it's just the Avengers and the rest of the world. Did you know why?
No.
Because
I never even knew that was a thing.
Yeah. We're so stupid here that we might get confused with Sir Peel and Steed, so they had to call it Avengers Assemble.
Well, do you know, that's probably a decent point, actually. But only people of a certain age.
Yeah, for a certain age, oldies.
That's
like
probably not the target audience, let's be fair. We're the ones who take the kids in to see it. But
And I must admit, when people say to me, I really liked Avengers Assemble, part of me is like, it's Avengers. It's just Avengers.
This podcast is good. We're going to be talking about Avengers Assemble.
Tune in. You can join us, dear listener.
Yes, please do.
Let us know what you think. All right, take it easy.
Thank you.